All right. Well, thank you so much for being here. I wanted to start by saying, like we were talking beforehand, that I'm doing this primarily because of taking your class. So I took it and I was just completely interested the whole time. I was a little bit daunted at first, or it was a little bit daunting. I don't really like doing presentations, and we had a couple, but I ended up just loving them, and your feedback was great. And I just really liked the way you set up your class.
Thank you so much.
No problem. So I'm really excited to have you here. It's exciting for me to be able to talk to you in person. It's nice to finally meet you. My first question was just, so why evolutionary psych? Have you always been interested in it? Or?
So I started out studying psychology in my undergrad. And when I originally started that path, I thought I would get into counseling or clinical psychology. Mm-hmm. And I took one course in evolutionary psych and loved it. And then I decided to do the honors program, which means I needed to meet with I'd have a mentor or a supervisor. And I ended up working in a lab that was really mixed between biology and psychology that used a lot of evolutionary frameworks. And yeah, it just kind of hooked me. And I'd say mainly because I like the really broad explanatory power.
Yeah.
You know, that you can kind of have these simple ideas and it seems to give you a lot of information about why people are the way that they are. Mm-hmm. So I did kind of start thinking I would study more the individual, but then I got more into this, like studying like the species or like kind of group dynamics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense. You said you're finishing your PhD right now?
I'm on maternity leave still.
Right.
But I'm going to start back up in January.
Okay.
And hopefully be done by the summer.
Well, that's exciting.
I don't want to set a hard deadline.
Cause yeah, no, of course.
Going back to school with two little kids and my husband works full time, so there's a lot of logistics to sort out, but I'm hoping in June is kind of feeling like a good goal.
That's
to
good.
Finish. Yeah,
it's exciting. What is it like going through the process of being a PhD candidate? Is it pretty intense? Or
I think my path has been pretty unique because I ended up doing my master's degree and my PhD with the same person, with Bernie Crespi at SFU. Mm-hmm. And lots of people recommend not doing that because like it's good to branch out and work with different people. But for me, it was really important that I could have the type of lifestyle and schedule. I wasn't ready to throw myself into a PhD where I'd have to like move far away or like commit to crazy work hours.
Right.
So I am a student at Simon Fraser, which is in BC. Mm-hmm. So I do all my work remote. And since Bernie and I had already had a good relationship, he was willing to be a little bit flexible on what I was studying because I initially wanted to work on a project about the origins of the female orgasm.
Mm-hmm.
And I was having a hard time finding someone local that had the right approach. So I talked to him and we kind of found a way we could work on it together. And so the program was kind of unique to me because it's all been remote. It's been like mostly self-study. And overall, that's been good because I could work my own hours and, you know, work in a coffee shop.
Right.
But I ended up really missing the social aspect, which I didn't really realize until recently.
That's fair.
But then it ended up working out because with the pandemic, I would have been working this style anyway. So I was already used to working that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah, it's changed a lot for everyone, I think. Unfortunately, I'm not a huge fan of it, of working remote, but it does definitely have its pros.
Yeah, I miss like being around other people, which is why I usually like to leave my house and work. Cause I have a hard time actually getting work done at home.
Yeah,
I like the hustle and bustle of an environment.
I've heard too before that, I don't know if it's true, but that there's something about being able to leave and go to an office or to a classroom just because you're separating like your relaxation environment from your work environment. I don't know how much evidence there is to it.
It makes sense to me, like just in terms of conditioning principles. Like people say too, to not do like work in your bed or bring your computer into your bed because that should be the place where you relax.
Exactly.
Yeah, and in my house, I usually have the kids there even if someone's watching them, and it's just way too chaotic to get work
done.
Yeah,
no kidding. So the origins of the female orgasm, why did you pick that topic?
So funny enough, in my undergrad, when I first took evolutionary psychology, that's what I wrote my research paper on.
Oh, yeah?
And so that would have been probably in 2006. So I've been following this area of literature for a long time. Mm-hmm. The question in evolutionary psych is this, like, why do females have orgasms? Because the male orgasm has an obvious function because it's connected with the ejaculation mechanism. Mm-hmm. So it's clearly tied to reproduction, but in women, there's not an obvious tie. Like, women can get pregnant without having an orgasm or never having had an orgasm. But there's like features of orgasm that, or orgasm seems to be more likely with males that have certain indicators of fitness. So there's this been a big debate, you know, for a long time, and this is a debate I've been following, that it either was selected for because it contributes to female reproductive success in some way, or that it's a byproduct of males having orgasms. And so I was following that debate, and I originally wrote my paper like back when I was an undergrad saying that it had a function in terms of mate choice. So females being more likely to have orgasms with males of high quality, and it would reinforce that bond. And then I shifted away from that. And sometime during my master's degree, I got really interested in this idea that orgasm has to have some relationship to childbirth. And I hadn't seen anyone just look at that or study it at all. So that was the idea I got really hooked on. And I worked on that a lot in my PhD. But funny enough, that's the project that's undone and that needs more work. And now I've had two babies too. So now I have some personal experience with birth. And it's still kind of this like, I'm not quite sure where I'm going with the project.
That's fair.
But I wanted to connect the two worlds of like female sexuality and childbirth. Because they are usually studied really separately, and they're often really studied like from a pathology perspective, what goes wrong with both. And I wanted to explore the kind of mechanisms that overlap in both of them.
Did you find anything?
Yeah, I have to bring my brain to focus because like it's been a while since I kind of needed a break from that. But well, firstly, there are like a small you know, group of women that do have orgasms during childbirth. So that's interesting. And
there's really?
Yeah. And there's a kind of more in the natural birth world, or we maybe even call it the ecstatic birth world, and this idea of kind of like surrendering to the bodily processes, and like allowing the intensity of the sensations can create the possibility to have orgasm. And so some women do actually experience childbirth as pleasurable, but it seems to be a pretty small amount. Like, you know, obviously, like most people would say, it's like the most painful.
Yeah. I don't know if this is true, but I've always heard that it's on par with like being lit on fire. Like, so I don't.
I've never been lit on fire. But I would say, especially my first birth, like the intensity of it like shocked me. And like, I've been like a pretty athletic person, or, you know, I've done things, I don't know, like had tattoos or piercings or, and like committed to some pretty intense physical activity, but it shocked me, like the amount of physical strength and endurance I needed to have, and mental toughness to get through it. Cause I was really committed to having a natural birth as well.
Right.
So I didn't have any drugs or inductions, and I was at home too. But in terms of its connection to orgasm, I guess what I'm struggling with is the like, trying to see if there's some kind of like causal relationship between the two. So I did explore a bunch of literature that suggests, maybe not directly, but at least indirectly, that women who are more orgasmic or more like open sexually would have an easier time giving birth.
Right.
And I was thinking that would have some like psychological and physical explanations, right? If like the pelvic floor is more relaxed, if a woman's more aware of her body, if she's able to relax through intense sensations, then the process of both orgasm and birth, which are like a fairly automatic process, can unfold less inhibited. So sort of like psychological and physical inhibitions. But I also studied the hormonal overlap, because there's a lot of hormonal similarities between the two too, like the peak in oxytocin. So this is kind of the project I have to finish up to finish my PhD, because I have a whole other section of research on a different topic that's fairly done.
Oh, I see. It's really interesting. It seems like you've done quite a bit already. So
yeah, it just feels like it's like the main connection is still missing. But I'm thinking maybe it doesn't need to be like a finished story. I can bring up what I want to do is like point out missing gaps, because you know, as lots of academia, it's mostly been men writing on it. And sometimes when I read the female orgasm literature, it's like, it's like a big part of the story missing, and I just wanted to bridge those two worlds. because there's a lot of reasons why, you know, people haven't researched childbirth or sexuality a lot, because those have been taboo subjects.
I was reading some of your stuff from your website, and it seemed like a lot of the historical ideas for the causes are pretty ridiculous. Like,
yeah,
just don't really make a whole lot of sense, like, intuitively.
There's some pretty comical ones out there. Like, the idea that the orgasm tires a woman out, so she lays flat on her back for a while so the semen doesn't fall out, and then she's more likely to get pregnant. Because a lot of people have tried to make that link, and there's still, like, there's modern versions of that where the orgasm through the oxytocin in, like, makes the uterus contract, and then it pulls up the sperm. But the evidence for that is just not very strong. So, because there's still no link. Like, women who've never had an orgasm get pregnant all the time. So
it's kind of, it seems like they're just looking for just any kind of easy way to explain it, almost.
People, and this has been a criticism, and Elizabeth Lloyd has written a big book on the female orgasm and using it as an example of how there's a lot of bias in evolutionary studies, because she's like, people are so fixated on, like, it has to have an explanation or it has to have a reason, where she's like, a lot of things in, you know, evolution end up being a byproduct or like a kind of an outcome of some other pressure. And she's, and she kind of goes at it from a feminist angle, like, why does it have to have a function? Like, maybe it's just this great happy accident that evolution created.
No kidding. Well, speaking of byproducts, you mentioned that at one point that it might be a byproduct of the male orgasm.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
So, and this is, Elizabeth Lloyd talks about this idea, and some biologists before her time too, that, so since male orgasm is, it is a different mechanism than ejaculation, but they're tied together in, you know, most of the time. And since there's a lot of pressure, selective pressure on ejaculation to work properly, so we can say there's strong selection on male orgasm, and males and females, you know, develop very similarly embryologically. So the male would need, you know, erectile tissue to develop in utero, and because of those overlapping embryological developmental processes, females end up with the erectile tissue as well. And so we end up with a capacity to orgasm, but it doesn't, it's not connected to a function. So that's sort of the byproduct idea. So the two main parts, the strong selection on male orgasm and the shared development. Yeah, and some people really dislike that idea too, but it might be the one that, like, best fits the evidence. I think I'm leaning toward that account explains orgasms that come from more like clitoral stimulation, because the clitoris and the penis are homologous. But I think other aspects of female orgasmic nature, like deeper orgasms, ones that come from more cervical region, I think they need to have a bit of a different explanation. That's been kind of the angle I'm leaning toward.
Did you always, like, leaving high school, did you always know you're going to go into school and, like, take, like, some kind of route, whether it be evolutionary psychology and your PhD or just something else? Like, were you always sure that you were going to university?
I loved school. I always did really well in school.
Right.
It was the, like, structured environment was good for me. I always got high grades and based a lot of my self-esteem on getting high grades. And as soon as I was able to apply to university, like, I think I applied for university in September of my grade 12 year. Like, I was ready. And I lived in a small town, so I was really excited to get out into a big city too. So, yeah, but my path definitely ended up being kind of different than I thought it would be. I didn't plan to go into academia. That sort of was an accident. I bet a lot of people in academia say that.
That's fair. You studied in Vancouver as well?
Is that correct? Yeah, Simon Fraser University's in Burnaby, so right outside of Vancouver.
And you were there at one point, correct?
Like, yeah, I lived there when I did my master's degree.
Right.
So that would have been 2010 to 2012.
And you busked a little bit in Vancouver, correct?
Yes.
How was that out in Vancouver? I feel like it's pretty lively. Not Vancouver exactly.
What you said? But we, I had a friend, have a friend named Johannes who plays violin. And at that time I was doing a lot of like pole dancing and sort of like somewhat erotic performance, but still kind of like PG enough to be out in public. And we ended up just making this act where he would play violin and I would pole dance, and we were doing it in Gastown, which is a pretty touristy district, and It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I bet. It seems like it would be.
Yeah, and we got good feedback. Like, people loved it.
Just good. Nobody, there wasn't, do you ever have any problems?
You know, the odd, like, creepy person, right. But that was dealt with pretty easily. But yeah, we would busk until we were kind of too tired and then count up all our money and go buy a burger and have a beer. And it was nice.
That's good. It seems like the type of life that people are looking for when they go out there all the time, too. Not necessarily busking in particular, but just when I was reading an article that somebody wrote on you doing that. And it just, from the responses you were giving him, it seemed like it was really freeing, almost, like just being able to go out there and just, just pursue what you wanted to, it seemed like.
Yeah, just to, because that kind of performance I was doing, obviously pole dancing you mostly find in a strip club.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't, you know, end up going into that kind of work ever. I had lots of friends at that time that were, because I got into pole dancing originally through fitness, and it was kind of from this female empowerment, you know, like loving your body. And I started that in Edmonton, and then I kind of brought it with me to Vancouver. And sometimes it was hard to find, you know, performance venues, because my performance partner and I were looking for places kind of that would want to host our act. But like,
right.
It's kind of hard to explain to people, and it's kind of weird, and that's you need quite a bit of space or set up the portable pole. And at that time I was doing a bit of performance at music festivals and like kind of in rave culture too. And the busking, I'm not even sure how he came up with the idea, but Johannes was he had been involved kind of in like circus performance before. Okay. So we were just let's just, you know, if we like can't find somewhere to do it, we'll just like do it on the street.
Right. Yeah. No, it seemed really cool. And you said you started in Edmonton. Like, were you taking classes?
Yeah, I did my undergrad in Edmonton at U of A. So I grew up in a small town outside of Edmonton, moved to Edmonton for school. And then while I was in school, I ended up getting hired to teach pole dancing fitness. Oh, yeah. I had a long background with dance. How I found out about pole dancing, I was on the Edmonton Rush lacrosse team, dance team. Just like a funny chapter of my life, because it ended up overall being kind of a really bad experience.
Oh, no, really?
And now I guess the Edmonton Rush is actually in Saskatchewan, right? It's a Saskatchewan team.
Yeah,
we
have the Sasquatch.
Yeah, so me and some of my dance friends, like my sister and a few of our friends, we saw, I think this was my first year of university, saw like advertisements for like tryout to be on the dance team for the new lacrosse team. And, you know, it's like a national sport. I'm like, oh, that'd be really cool.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a cheer team, because, you know, football have cheerleaders and we were dancers, and there's kind of like a difference between the two. And we tried out and made it onto this team, and it was, just a very unique experience, because they have certain rules, like you're supposed to come off as like desirable, so you're not supposed to tell people that you have a boyfriend, and you know, you get like free tanning minutes and like hairstyling. This feels like a different age.
but really, really about the image.
Right? Oh, yeah. Yeah. And like, I got put on probation once for like being too fat.
Really?
Yeah. And it was at that time I ended up, another woman on the team named Nicole, she had been teaching pole dancing fitness. She's like, and she just saw that I would like it. Like, I had never done it before. She's like, I think you should like this. Like, you should come check out our studio. And then I ended up like working for the pole dancing studio and then quitting the Edmonton Crush, we were called. Quitting that at the same time, which was really good for my
personal health. It probably felt good to walk away.
Yeah, it did. There was it was a lot of drama, and just people weren't treated super well. Yeah. It was a neat experience, like to be like, I'm on a national sport dance team, and the Edmonton Rush lost every game that season too. So it was kind of hard to stay like hyped up when your team lost every single game.
So when you were teaching it, is it like, when you're teaching pole dancing, is it purely from like the fitness and like the fitness side of it, or is there like, is I don't even know how to ask this question. Are you like trying to teach the sensuality of it as well?
Yeah. I was, when I worked, the first company I worked at, Aradia, it was came from the female empowerment perspective. So you're like helping women get comfortable in their bodies, helping women feel comfortable like dancing sexily. Because we'd have lots of women be like, oh, I'm not sexy, or like, I can't move like that, and just kind of giving them like the opening or the invitation, like it's okay to move like that.
Yeah.
So that was a really fun atmosphere. And we also would teach lots of stagettes and bachelorette parties. So like women would come with all their friends and for an hour, and you teach a fun little dance and take pictures with the bride. Yeah. And yeah, at that time, like, I loved it. It was so fun. And it was great, like, extra income while I was in school. And now, you know, that I'm older, looking back on it, I've, like, been exposed to different kinds of, say, feminist critiques around pole dancing. Because there's kind of, like, in the early days, it's like, well, I'm a pole dancer, not a stripper. And there's this sort of, like, built-in, like, oh, like, I don't want to be a stripper. And now I've seen, you know, women who work in, like, nightclubs, you know, doing, like, nude pole dancing. It's like they can see some of the women in the fitness world as, like, appropriating, you know, their dancing.
Oh, really?
Like, just how we talk about cultural appropriation. Yeah. It's like, oh, you, like, learn the moves from strippers, and then you're going to be like, oh, but I'm not like them. Oh. I'm going to take it and, like, sell it to, you know, wealthy women who kind of want to feel naughty but who won't get judged for it. So it's neat having... I'm not doing that right now, but when I was in that world long enough to kind of have these different perspectives on it.
That's an interesting dichotomy. I never thought that it would have, that would have never occurred to me.
Yeah, and it ends up being kind of controversial when it starts out as sort of, you know, this thing that, like, should be helping women and is, but then it can kind of create almost, I guess, like, woman to woman fighting or discontent. But yeah, I ended up kind of just tapering off pole dancing leading up to the time I got pregnant. I think I just intuitively knew that my body needed different sort of exercise. It's like very athletic and intense, and it contrasts a lot with how you want your body to be while you're pregnant or birth giving.
That's fair. There's a woman right now, I think, that has been trending, and she's she didn't stop her weightlifting program when she was pregnant, and she claims it's safe. I didn't really look into it much. I just saw, I came across one video. But she was like, I think she was like still 6-7 months and was doing like Olympic weightlifting still. And the comments were giving her a lot of flack, but she was claiming that it was completely safe. It just reminded me of that because you
were talking. Yeah, like, I have some friends that lifted weights all through their pregnancy. I wasn't really ever a big weightlifter, so I think it would probably depend on where your body was at before you got pregnant. But just in terms of like the pelvic floor and abdominal muscles go through so much change, and the hormones in our body when we're pregnant, they make your tissue, like, really soft and gooey. So you don't have as much, like, structure to hold your body in. And if you're doing things where you're really trying to, like, hold it tight, they could also make your pelvic floor a lot tighter.
I see.
Which would be more challenging giving birth if there's, like, a lot of tension. But I'm sure, I always say, like, in general, you know, women kind of know their bodies the best. Yeah, with pole dancing, it's so much core work. So, like, the abdomen just becomes, like, very tight and engaged, and it's good to let it soften when we're pregnant and preparing for birth.
Yeah, no kidding. So you've been teaching pole dancing in classes, and you're doing your research as well. Of the two, between teaching and doing research, which would you prefer, do you think? Like, are you...
I just to be clear, I haven't been teaching dance for a while now, kind of since I had my babies. But they balance each other really nicely, because PhD work is so mental and, like, sedentary, and then dancing is a nice way to get back in my body and kind of out of my head. So I like doing them both. I was teaching a little bit, like, freeform dance after I had my daughter, but then that stopped, and then the pandemic hit, so there hasn't really been opportunity, you know, for group fitness classes. Yeah.
So how'd you get into lecturing specifically?
Okay. That's actually funny too. I met my now husband, then boyfriend. We were both in Vancouver at the same time, but he's from Saskatchewan, and I had finished school, and he wanted to come back to U of S to finish his bachelor's degree, and so he asked me to move with him. And we had just started dating, but we were in love, and I was like, you know what, I'm gonna do it. And it was kind of spontaneous, and we moved to Saskatchewan together. And while we were preparing to move, I had applied to lecture at U of S, and I thought it was a long shot because I only had a master's degree. And then I was really surprised. They actually offered me a job.
That's probably exciting.
It was really exciting because I didn't think that was even possible. But about, like, a week or two after they offered me the job, they called me back. I'm like, sorry, we actually can't give you the job because someone with more seniority applied for that contract, and we, like, missed their paper. So they have like the teaching unions have these strict rules. Like if you've been teaching a course so many times, you get first rights over that course if you're not part of the faculty. So I was totally crushed because I got the job offer and then they rescinded it. But then it didn't take long, like a year or two, where I did get a contract. And then I did a bunch of teaching for the distance ed group at U of S. Mm. So I was teaching personality psychology kind of through correspondence. And then eventually I got the evolutionary psych lecture, which was really exciting. And I've been doing that for quite a while now.
I really enjoyed your class. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and people love it because it, you know, talks about all these like real world things, mm-hmm. like sex and relationships. That's kind of, I think, the big one that catches people's attention.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I really enjoyed that. I felt like it was actually, I was learning about things that I could observe all right. the time. Just like stuff I could think of examples in my own life for most of the concepts we talked about, which is really cool because it actually feels a little bit more engaging that way, I found.
Yeah. Yeah, because sometimes I think some of the psychology can feel a bit removed. Because I always said, especially with, say, sex differences, which in today's culture is like a very controversial topic, and I've spent a lot of time studying that topic, like a best place to see evolutionary psychology in action is go to a playground and like watch mm-hmm. all the little boys and girls playing, and you can really see some differences
in just
how they navigate each other and the equipment and all of that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I don't know. When I was reading it, when I was taking the course, I would, after class all the time, my dad and I would talk about everything. And that was his observation as well. He was just, every time I'd say something new that I learned, he'd be like, this just seems like all the stuff that he believed. Like he was, this is just, it all made sense to him.
Right.
He was like, this just seems like logical.
Right.
So I thought that was really cool. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's where some of the criticisms of evolutionary psychology come from too, where people are like, oh, you're just confirming like stereotypes or intuitions and it's not really scientific. But yeah, I think it does appeal to people because they like sense like, yeah, like, you know, humans do have that relationship to the rest of the animal mm-hmm. world, and you can see this continuity and patterns of behavior.
Yeah. Yeah, I think people give it a lot of flack sometimes because it's hard to test hypotheses, but I don't know. I didn't get the sense that it made it any less valid. Like it all still seemed just as true or just as valid as any of the other psych classes I was taking. So.
Yeah, and I think, and you know, this might be my own bias, but I feel like it has to be understood on a bit of a different level because it's the type of psychology that unites all of the other kinds.
Mm-hmm.
Like in my master's degree, I did a lot of work on evolutionary origins of mental illness, and I think it helps like clinical psychology if you have some evolutionary footing, because mm-hmm. like it would be the same thing, you know, if people are studying like kinesiology or the body, you have to understand sort of like, you know, how your shoulder develops or why is it prone to certain kinds of injuries or how is it supposed to function. It's the same thing with our mind or social skills, like how are they supposed to function, or like mm-hmm. why, what kind of problems do they solve or what possibilities do they have, and like how can they get, you know, distorted or injured right. through time.
Yeah. A topic I was really excited to ask you about was astrology. So you are an astrological consultant, is that right?
I give people readings.
Right.
I still like calling myself a student of astrology because astrology is like the deepest subject that someone can fall into.
Mm.
And that's how a lot of people describe it. Like it kind of, astrology comes and gets you, I suppose, the other way around.
This is fair.
So yeah, I do like accept money for readings. It's not my full-time thing, mm-hmm. but I've been doing it on and off probably for about 7 years. I haven't for a couple years because of babies and the pandemic, but I was doing readings at the Fringe Festival,
mm-hmm.
which is really fun.
Yeah, I bet. I didn't look up any, once I saw that you did that on your website, I didn't look any further into it because I wanted you to explain it to me. I don't really know much about astrology. I know what my sign is.
Right.
That's about it.
What's your sign?
I'm a Sagittarius.
Oh, nice. And so your birthday's coming up pretty soon.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. On the 17th year. Nice. Yeah. I've never really looked into it a whole lot. I'll be honest with you. I don't know if I agree with you, but I really wanted to see, I wanted you to explain it to me because I don't.
Yeah. And I've definitely had people in the science community judge me for studying astrology. There was actually a professor at U of S, I won't name them, but I approached them to maybe work with for my PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And he like, you know, saw my grades and my scholarship work and was like, oh yeah, like this is great. And then we had a meeting and he checked out my website and saw I did astrology and was just offended and like that's the same thing as believing in ghosts, and like how can you, you know, do both. And like it was the grounds for him not wanting to work with me, which is fine because maybe, you know, we wouldn't have gotten along.
Yeah, I guess so, right?
To me, like, if we think about science as a method, not as a religion, but I think especially in the pandemic times, it's clear like some people treat science like a religion, like the scientist said so, it must be true, or this is what science says. And I think we have to keep reminding people that science is a method, a cumulative method through time, practiced by fallible people. And even though astrology is really the roots of science, because it involves like a lot of observation and categorization and like tracking things through time and making correlations. But I would approach astrology with a different mindset. So part of it is just being tied to nature, like, you know, kind of paying attention to how you feel in different seasons. Like, you know, people think of astrology as the planets, and that's obviously a huge part of it, but it's like a, that life has this like cyclical nature, you know, things grow and things die and things, you kind of feel different ways throughout the year. And like that to me is just true by experience. Like even just on my Facebook the other day, I was saying something about like the Sagittarius sun, because we're in Sagittarius season. I went for a walk yesterday and Sagittarius has this quality of like clarity, like mental clarity and like brightness. Like they really want to see and like think to new heights. And Saskatoon to me is such a nice place in Sagittarius season because, you know, all the leaves are gone from the trees. The sky is clear. It's kind of cold. And like the sun just shines in this really beautiful way. And so like that's some of the ways I relate to astrology. Like it kind of helps me make sense of my relationship to nature. And people who, sciencey people who get really like offended by astrology, I think they have a little bit too much hubris because astrology is like an ancient practice. And like I said, it's the roots of science. And, you know, at one point astrology and astronomy were wedded together. And this idea that astrology like should kind of be tossed aside, like I think that's shows that people haven't looked into it deeply enough. And not like everyone needs to study it, but it's such a, like, you know, every culture has some form of astrology. It ties things together like imagination, myth, and storytelling with repeated cycles through time, with careful observation, development of technology. Like it permeates every part of being a human and like having culture. So it is, it's a sacred thing to me. And yeah, I really like practicing it. And I don't, it's funny that you bring this up because I just, I have Twitter. I don't use it a lot. Like I don't tweet a lot, but I read other people's stuff. But last night I tweeted something about how people who are really sciencey, and I say that as kind of like, you know, they think they believe in science, but maybe they don't fully understand what science is, will have this criticism like, oh, like, well, there's no mechanism. You know, like we don't, like, how can a planet affect a person? And because they don't see a mechanism, they think that it can't, can't work. And then I've had this, had people offer the same criticism when we're talking about other phenomena. So one of my friends who's a big advocate in women's health was saying how she's observed that the COVID vaccine has affected lots of women's menstrual cycles. And someone's like, well, the evidence is showing that it doesn't have a big effect. And also there's no mechanism by which it should. And I just kind of drew that parallel and it bothers me because people are limiting. It's like, okay, if I can't imagine, or if I don't know what the mechanism is that links those two things, like there's no way it could be connected. And I just feel like that's like a really big barrier to put on our understanding. Cause if, you know, we might not understand why the planets seem to have this influence on people's day-to-day life and how they behave and express themselves, but like enough people can observe that they are connected. There's some kind of connection or correlation. So like just because we don't know what the mechanism is, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and like I said, like, I'm not, I'm not sure that I believe in it, but I would never go so far to tell you you're wrong, just because, right. Like, I find, like, you're talking about people drawing that parallel, well, this doesn't have, let's say that there's no mechanism in astrology, but then they will use that same argument to kind of push away, like, other findings that are considered more scientific,
mm-hmm.
but it just, I don't know, I guess I just agree with you. I don't know why there would have to be, or why you'd have to prove something like that. I don't know. I guess it's, I'm just trying to say that. I think it's ignorant of people to just pretend that they know that it's untrue.
I think it's the wrong like order of events. Because say, like, there's that famous example in science, you know, Semmelweis and the hand washing. I don't know if you've learned that through science, but like Semmelweis was, I don't know if he was a doctor or a scientist. I don't quite remember the whole story. But yeah, it's kind of an example people use in teaching science, because he was doing hypothesis testing. Mm. And he's like, oh, maybe all of these, you know, women giving birth are dying because doctors aren't washing their hands after they touch the dead bodies. And that's what was happening. They were, you know, dealing with dead bodies and then going and putting their hands in women that were birthing. And then those women and their offspring were dying. And he's like, oh, maybe there's some kind of like invisible material that's transferred from the corpse to the woman and it makes them sick. And people were like, oh, sure, like invisible tiny material, like that's crazy. And, you know, and he didn't know the mechanism, like he didn't know germs or things like that. But he like was seeing that there was a connection, like, oh, the doctors that go from this hospital, that hospital, their patients die. But the doctors who just work in this part of the hospital, their patients don't die. So he saw a connection and then was trying to figure out explanations and mechanisms. And that's, I think, like, you know, when women are having this experience, like, oh, my menstrual cycle was affected by the vaccine, like, maybe there's a mechanism that explains it, instead of being like, oh, well, I can't imagine how there would be a mechanism, so there must not be. And I think that kind of comes from this, like, seeing the body as a machine metaphor, which I disagree with, and I think is outdated. And, you know, in astrology, you would see humans, like, you know, we're part of nature, we're embedded in the cycles of nature.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, well, exactly. I think just because you can't see something doesn't mean it's true. It's especially like, I don't know, I find those type of arguments are pretty odd too, because a lot of the time they come from people that are super religious but will discount astrology. And it's like, well, whereas like if like you're using an argument against something and then just like choosing not to use it in your own beliefs.
Right.
So
well, I'm pretty sure like I know in Christianity and maybe in Islam too, there are like warnings against using astrology.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't know my like Bible verses well enough, but there's definitely like, yeah, kind of like lecture against using the stars to portend. But there's a lot of astrological literature on all of the astrology references in Christianity. Like the three wise men as the three stars, Orion's belt, or something like that. That's a whole deep, interesting area too.
I think unfortunately people just, especially today, it seems like people are just picking teams and trying to make sure that nobody else is right.
That's definitely the world we live in.
Yeah. Do you think, like, from your studying or being a student of astrology, do you think there's a mechanism that, not necessarily one that you've learned or you think is true, but just something that you could observe, or just like an idea?
I think there has to be one. Like, there's certain techniques I use in astrology, and the way that they kind of like symbolically explain specific events in people's lives, like, I really do feel like there's one. That would be, you know, my like ultimate scientific accomplishment would be to figure that out.
The proving mechanism in astrology.
Yeah, and not like maybe the ultimate mechanism, but there's a specific technique I use. It's called secondary progressions. And what it does is it takes like the days following your birth and matches those onto a year. So like the third day of your life would have the astrological picture for the third year of your life. So kind of like the first, you know, 3 months of your life as a baby, like, kind of tells us about, you know, the 90 years of your life. And and that technique for me and my clients works really well. Like, it really maps out these kind of ebbs and flows and turning points in their life. And having studied a little bit of, you know, developmental biology, like we know the time in utero and the time after you're born, there's these sensitive periods where like parts of our biology are, for lack of a better word, like are programmed.
Right.
You know, or even when we talk about, say, like really early trauma, like how much that imprints a person's personality or their nervous system. So I think that there is something like physical and observable there.
Hmm.
I'm not quite sure where to look, but I've pondered it a little bit. I've chatted with a few people about it. It's kind of my, like, I know maybe it'll be my project when I'm retired or when my kids are older, but it's like in the background, like it's always kind of percolating there.
It's definitely an interesting topic.
Yeah. And there's this other mechanism in genetics. What's it called? It's called genetic assimilation, where say something, let's see if I can explain this right, because I might forget part of it, but say something like in our biology, I think like the circadian rhythm is an example of this, where originally it's like the presence of the light, you know, makes our brain release certain hormones. So we follow this like day-night cycle. But eventually that, instead of it being the light that triggers it, a genetic mechanism like takes over it. So a human could be away from light for a long time, and there's, you know, genes in cells in their brain that are creating that hormonal cascade in absence of light. So something that was in the environment becomes assimilated into the genetic instructions. And I wonder if that is somehow connected to astrology, because a big part of astrology is just light.
Yeah.
Like we study the sun and the moon a lot. And
So you mean like cosmic patterns and cycles just kind of like being mapped out on genes, and then they take over when it's not necessarily available sometimes?
Yeah, maybe that would explain how like we can look at the sky and see a pattern and see how that kind of relates to someone's experience, but like there's not maybe still that causal connection between the two, but somehow our body like incorporated these patterns into our development.
Right.
So yeah, that's sort of my like initial thoughts on it, but I think it's a problem worthy of consideration. I think any good astrologer has really pondered what the mechanisms are, and some accept, like, I don't really know, but I trust that the method works, so I use it. And then some people have, you know, their own explanation. Even just like, oh, our bodies are mostly made of water and gravity, and heavenly bodies like, you know, pull on the water, like the tides. Like some people just use that.
Oh, I had a question, but I can't. I think a lot of people attribute cold reading to astrology. Is that like, I guess I was just wondering if like, so when you take like a Sagittarius like myself, for example, does everybody born in that time frame have to be explainable under that lens, or like
how that's what we would call sun sign astrology, where you're like looking at people's kind of personality characteristics based on the time of year that they were born. And in the broad system of astrology, that's a really small part, because what we do is we look at kind of the whole sky. So we look at all of the planets and their geometrical patterns with each other too. And this kind of goes back to like Pythagoras and like Platonic and Aristotelian philosophy, where like some geometrical patterns are more harmonious. And then there's also like elemental approaches too. Like if someone, you know, it's just sort of like a Hippocrates, like it's older than that, but that idea of like, you know, people who are more fiery or more watery. So we would expect that all like Sagittarius people have like some things in common.
Right.
Like I was saying with like the clarity of mind or being high-minded, like Sagittarius is kind of associated with like higher education, and like with teaching. Even so, even like you being interested in, you know, hearing the stories of teachers, like that's sort of like a Sagittarius theme in general. But sun sign astrology would definitely be limited. It's like a really kind of like quick, like I'd call it pop astrology.
Right.
You know, people are like, oh, what's my sign? But yeah, we look at a lot of things. Like something I look at really closely is lunar phase. Like were you born during a full moon or a new moon? And that actually has a pretty big imprint I've observed on people's personality.
You,
seems to.
Yeah. I had another question about, so with astrology, Are you trying to look at how you should interact with the world, or how the world is making you behave? Or sorry, not even, no, I guess not the world necessarily, but you know where I'm going with that?
Yeah, I think like there's that question of kind of determinism or fate and free will.
Right, yeah, that's where it's going.
And there's you know aspects of more traditional ancient astrology that do seem more deterministic, where like you might see things described more as like, oh, like a bad astrology chart or a good, like this is a good thing, that's a bad thing. And modern astrology, I think, has some great innovations in like talking about like how like things that aren't always like, you can't always classify as good or bad, but it's maybe like a challenge or an opportunity for someone to grow. But I think practicing astrology like teaches me that everyone is so unique from one another, and that it gives me more empathy for people. Because say like maybe you know someone and they have like a certain, you know, complex or an issue, or they're kind of always doing something that like annoys you, and you're like, oh, why are they always so insecure? Why are they always late? Or I don't know, like little things about people, that little quirks that can kind of bug people. And when I look at someone's chart, you're kind of like, oh, like I can really see how that would be like a big struggle for them.
Right.
And then it gives me a little bit more compassion. So that's like the actual art of practicing astrology teaches me that. And it really helps like honor people as individuals, which is what I like about it. So I don't know if it like, you know, tells people to live a certain way. And even within astrology, people would have different approaches. Like there's people who kind of come at it from more of the magical tradition. Like, okay, I want this thing in my life, so I'm going to track the sky and like do a magic spell at a certain time to try to, you know, get myself more money or get myself a job. And then there'd be people who maybe more, and see like this, I'd say is more like observable in Chinese astrology, where like you're trying to harmonize with your environment. It's like, okay, like today's going to be a really challenging day, so I'm going to lay low and maybe just clean my house.
I see.
As opposed to trying to like press your will into the world, as opposed to like, okay, I'm observing the quality of the day or the year and trying to go with that instead of fight against it.
Right. It doesn't actually seem too far off of what I believe, to be honest. Do you know about the Tao, like the
a little bit, yeah. Yeah.
I subscribe not fully to that, but I'm really into the ancient Chinese studies of stuff like that, like the way of the universe and force of the universe. So it seems fairly similar.
Yeah, and Chinese astrology has like it's, you know, deeply connected to the I Ching, and it's really old. Mm-hmm. And from what I've studied about it a little bit is that Chinese astrology seems to actually have quite a bit of like empirical roots. Like there was a lot of observation and kind of like creating the system based on what they observed through time. And it was about like harmonizing, like, oh, like, you know, babies are born in the spring, so one shouldn't go to war in the spring because that's when life is happening. So like go and kill people at war in the fall because that's when things are dying. Like there's this sort of like, going with the flow of things.
Well, I think they follow it quite a bit still, don't they, as well?
Like, as far as I know, I don't want to speak too much about it. Like,
yeah.
I've learned a lot of Chinese astrology from my friend Sue. And, you know, we're both like white Western European background, but she's lived a long time in Indonesia and has learned from some Chinese masters. So I think she has a little bit more idea of how it fits with the culture than I would. But yeah, I think like there's definitely people that, like say in matchmaking, like parents might not want their child to marry someone of a certain sign because it might pretend like a less happy or more fortunate marriage.
I've heard that the birth rates change quite a bit year to year too, just following like
I've heard that too. Yeah, like what is it, like a horse year, like horse children aren't seen as, they're kind of like maybe harder to tame.
Right. Yeah.
So people want like a rabbit or a dragon baby because they're luckier.
I've heard dragon is really popular.
Yeah, because dragon, you know, in the Chinese signs, dragon is the only like mystical animal. Like all of the other ones are, you know, worldly animals. Mm-hmm. So the dragon sort of has this like power and intrigue, I guess, that the other signs don't.
Yeah. So I really like that. I studied it a lot in, I guess not studied, but I was really into it in elementary school. It was always really interesting to me.
And yeah, I've sometimes really it just intrigues people, right?
Yeah.
Or it resonates, I'd say, like, that word can get used a lot, like, overused maybe in New Age culture, but it's true, like, some things you read and you're like, that really does feel like it captures some part of me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've studied personality psychology and taught it a little bit. And, you know, there's like the Jungian tests and the Myers-Briggs, like all of these different. But for me, like, astrology feels a lot like it captures more of people than those tests do, mm-hmm. in my personal opinion. Yeah. Maybe betraying psychology, but that's how I feel.
We don't have much more time. There's one subject that I wanted, one more subject I wanted to get into. To quote you from one of your, I think it was one of the blog posts, you said, "The notion that you can simply remove a uterus from a woman and insert it into a male body has got to be the most perfectly aggravating example of reductionist biology I have encountered." I learned about this, about uterus transplants, like last night. Or no, 2 nights ago. And then okay. I read your blog post and I was like, well, I didn't believe my buddy when he told me. I was like, I don't know. That doesn't, I just didn't believe him. And I read your blog post. And I agreed with you with the things you said. But yeah, I just was curious to, I wanted to hear you talk out loud about it.
Yeah, that's a controversial note to end on. That that blog post has by far been the most controversial piece of writing I ever put out. Like, I did lose friends over it. Mostly probably just one friend. But yeah, I mean, it comes out of my interest in this whole sex and gender culture war, and also a little bit from my just personal beliefs about, like, honoring nature, right. the female body, like, the process of life and creation. And yeah, when I heard or read, I don't remember how I found the first paper, but I was studying something, like, for my PhD work, and somehow I found this, like, oh, like, could we do uterus transplants into trans women? And I was just, I was so deeply offended. That was my honest reaction, that I had to write something, especially having a little bit of experience, like research experience in women's healthcare, like the kinds of things that women are suffering with every day, like, you know, endometriosis, adenomyosis, like infertility, PCOS, and, you know, waiting so long to see doctors and not having good cures. And the fact that, like, research attention is kind of going into this kind of like science fiction direction. We're like, oh, like, could we do this to make like such a small group of people like kind of like feel happier maybe in their bodies? Like, it just seems to me like such a poor use of resources, and not to mention all like, yeah, the potential effects of the level of like experimentation with the body and, I do find problematic.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I know. I was reading it and I just everything you were saying, I actually started talking like out loud to myself as I was reading it. And that's like a pretty good sign for me that I know that I'm interested in something, is if nobody's around and I start making noises while I'm watching or reading something. And you said Frankenstein-esque at one point, and that's the part that stood out to me the most, I think, because I don't really have a stake in this conversation. I don't think, but you're talking about just how complex that system is, and to think that it just can be transplanted like that. It's
kind of like a car part.
Yeah.
Yeah. We come back to this idea of like people seeing the body as a machine, and you can just like add on or remove parts. And anyone who's kind of like lived the female reality, or that's studied female health from a more holistic perspective, like, just knows that's not true. Like, even like another part of my PhD work, I've been studying endometriosis in a lot of depth, and when women have really severe endometriosis or related conditions, sometimes they end up getting a hysterectomy, which is the, you know, removal of the uterus. And, you know, and some women want that because they experience so much pain and suffering from the disease. But we now know, like, removing the uterus has lots of downstream consequences that we're only just starting to understand, and one of them is dementia, like drop in IQ. So it's like, and you know, now we have trans men, so biological females that want to live as men, like, they're having hysterectomies at younger ages. I'm pretty sure even doctors in Saskatoon do them. And like, the idea that we should like cut out a healthy organ that has a part in like a whole body system because that person doesn't feel comfortable with it, I think that's dangerous territory to get into. And, you know, there's some interesting, you know, stories in the media, like where, like, or say, like, a woman like really wanted to be blind. Like, every now and then there's people who like identify with like a disabled experience. Like, I really want to be blind. And there's one example from a few years back where like a woman like purposely blinded herself.
Mm-hmm.
And really, and most people wouldn't be like, oh, that's a good idea. Like she wanted that. She identified as a blind person. And so she made herself blind. But like, it's a similar thing to what we're doing. Like, I identify as someone without a uterus. Like, I want a doctor to cut it out. And like, should those medical resources go toward cutting out a uterus? What are the downstream effects that we don't even really understand? And also, like, you know, is the person gonna regret that years later? Like,
I've heard a lot about that kind of stuff. Is that these decisions, even if it does help the person feel better in their body or psychologically, just that I've heard that a lot of the time, just anything along that route can have more negative impacts long term.
Yeah, and I don't think we fully understand. Like, another trend that's happening is, you know, more women getting mastectomies, so like getting their breasts removed, and not because of breast cancer, but because of how they prefer their body to look or how they feel they need their body to look to feel comfortable in their own skin. But something that happens when you have like a big surgery and lots of flesh removed is like massive amounts of scar tissue, and scar tissue can like cause adhesions like throughout your fascial network, and your fascial network is your whole body. And if you mess with one part of it, like it ricochets through your whole body. Right. And I watched this one video of a female who had her breasts removed, I think it was like 7 or 8 years ago, and she's still dealing with all these mobility and chronic pain issues from the scar tissue. And, you know, so under the medical principle of do no harm, like, is it less harmful to remove a healthy body part because that person, you know, thinks like emotionally, psychologically, that's what they want? And like, what are other ways of maybe helping people feel more comfortable in their own skin?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I personally think is a better idea. But I know there's lots of people who disagree with me. To me too, it's this interesting clash of kind of capitalism and like individual entitlement. The fact that like we think like, oh, because that surgery is available, like I should be able to have it. When there's, you know, there's lots of people who need all kinds of healthcare that aren't getting it for things that are like medically necessary.
Mm. Yeah, no, I agree with you. It seems like there could be a better use for those resources.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I think that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for coming on and being my first guest. I was very excited to have you.
I'm honored to be your first guest. That was really great.
Yeah, I really enjoyed our conversation.
You did your research well.
Thank you.
Awesome. Okay.